Before I start, I'm just going to tell you some of the resources that I've used. There's a book here, The Compact Guide to World Religions, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Judaism, Secularism, New Age. Good resource. This little booklet here, I think it's cost $3. The Facts on Hinduism, John Ankerberg, John Weldon. Excellent, excellent stuff. As far as Buddhism, the man to go to, he's a Christian by the name of J. Isamu Yamamoto. And he's got a book here called Buddhism, Taoism, and Other Far Eastern Religions. It's a very small, concise book, less than 100 pages, just going right to the facts. Now, this is a book, I have not read it yet, Death of a Guru, and it's a testimony of Ravi R. Maharaj, who was a guru who got saved. And I know it was promoted by the Berean Call, and so I haven't read it. So, again, always use discernment, but I seems like a really good guy, and I've seen him on a video, and I just love the guy, you know. So, good stuff. I actually got to give one of these out on the plane ride home to a Brahmin. You have three handouts, and one of them is on Hinduism, one on Buddhism. And you actually, that's my own notes. And then you have another one on Hinduism, objections and answers. So I'm just going to start with Hinduism. Now, as far as we know, Hinduism does, it's a very unique religion, has no clear founder, has no clear creed. It's not like a lot of religions where they have a creed. It's an amalgamation of a lot of different occultic teachings from all different places. The Dravidians, who were the natives of the land of India, and then the Aryans came. And it seems like they just formed by borrowing from a combination of other belief systems. There's not even a founder. So it's really, you know, when you study the history of it, it's just obvious that this thing just came together. But there's not a uniform belief system, believe it or not. It's not like all Hindus believe the same thing. And they accept that. It's not logical, but they accept that there can be different belief systems. You can be a Hindu and believe in one God. You can believe in many gods. You can believe in no God, and you can be a Hindu. A lot of what we see in postmodernism now is pretty much similar to a lot of what's happening in the world. Is kind of like this stuff going worldwide. But there are certain scriptures. So now what I want to say is, even though there's no uniformity in Hinduism, there are some basic common core beliefs. So I'll focus on those. And one of them is pantheism. The belief that all is God. So everything is God. Another common belief is reincarnation. Another common belief is pantheism, belief in many gods. How do you have both polytheism and pantheism at the same time? Well, they believe that the Hindu gods are really lesser, kind of like, we're all part of Brahman. There's this one ultimate reality called Brahman. And the goal is to really realize that he's really God, but it's an impersonal force. Yet they say Brahman doesn't know anything, and yet he can't be known. So a lot of this stuff doesn't make sense. You're probably understanding me properly, because it does not make sense. It doesn't make sense. It's just not logical. So basically, the belief, some common beliefs is, the universe is all one. There's two different worldviews: monism or dualism. Dualism can mean something else when you're talking about like the Gnostics, but we are dualists in the sense that we believe in a creator and a creation. Monism believes everything is one. There's no distinction. So and it pervades. It goes beyond just saying creator and creation. Everything is one. No, there shouldn't be distinctions in anything, which ultimately leads to the conclusion that evil and good are one and the same. Charles Manson believed in Hinduism. Charles Manson, there's a quote in here, if I have it, but basically said, if all is one, then what is evil? And this can easily be used to justify any evil. the consequences of this kind of belief system are devastating to a society. The people who wrote this book, they wrote this booklet especially to warn Americans what this thing does to a culture. And they said, look at the Indian culture. The reason the Indians are prospering now is because they've borrowed off of our belief system. We've come up with all the scientific discoveries and everything else, and they're using it now and getting educated. But this Hindu belief system would never produce, unless, by the grace of God, that type of knowledge or advancement in technology. So, the belief that, monism, all is one, pantheism, everything is God. Now, Maya is a big thing. Everything is an illusion. So, we're all an illusion. Brahman basically had this dream, we're all part of his dream. There's different ways of describing it, and there's different schools, but what I'm telling you are generally... I think the main beliefs or the majority beliefs. So we're all an illusion, and the goal is to really get out of the illusion. It's to reunite with Brahman. When you stop making distinctions, when you finally realize that everything is one, and guess what the conclusion is? You are God. So it really goes back to the lie of Genesis. That's really what it is. It's the lie of the serpent. The serpent is all throughout Hinduism. You see the serpent at the top of some Hindu temples. In Kundalini Yoga, it's the serpent force that rises up the chakras in your back that gives you illumination. It was the serpent in the garden that promised your eyes will be opened. And he promised this knowledge beyond what God revealed. So, the belief that all is one and that all is an illusion go hand in hand with the teaching that there's no distinction between good and evil. It's also Friedrich Nietzsche was into this stuff or involved in some way. Hitler was into it. By the way, the swastika is a Hindu symbol. It's funny because the first time I went to India, there were these two garage gates closing the door. One had the Star of David, one had the swastika. And they were not Jewish and they were not German. This is Hinduism. Hitler had, the swastika. I think who else was it? Charles Manson, I think, had a swastika on his head. These are Hindu symbols. And nihilism, you can see how nihilism, for those of you who don't know what nihilism is, it's a philosophy or a worldview that basically life is meaningless and purposeless. And nihilists like to just destroy the current society because it's all irrelevant. Well, you could see how Hinduism would really feed that type of a philosophy. All right, so yeah, there's the quote by Manson on the first page. So some Hinduism, so some related terms we already covered: pantheism, monism, Brahman, which is the ultimate reality, unknowing, unknowable, impersonal, and yet he's the ultimate reality. And in Hinduism, it's when you stop thinking that you really realize yourself. Self-realization is the goal. So they make this distinction between consciousness, but you have consciousness when you stop thinking. So this is Hinduism. Reincarnation, rebirth. So they do believe in reincarnation. And samsara is the cycle of death and rebirth. And so basically, just to see how these terms go together, so we're in this illusion right now, and karma is another big thing. It's a law of it's a law in which your actions in this life affect future lives. And the whole thing, the whole goal is moksha, which is to escape samsara, to escape this endless cycle of birth and rebirth. You might have to be born a million times. For some people, it's almost like hopeless that you'll ever escape, even after a million lifetimes, to escape karma and to achieve moksha. Where you'll be one with Brahman. You already are one with Brahman. Your true self, or your Atman, which is the word for soul. Even when I'm translating, every time I say spirit, they say Atman. It's the word for spirit. But in Hinduism, it's your true self. You see this term throughout the New Age movement, which we'll get to in a few weeks, God willing. But your true inner self is really Brahman. But you don't realize it. You have to, it's not enough to know the doctrine, like in Hinduism, well, I am Brahman. You have to know it experientially, through escaping samsara, and through ultimately realizing that you're God, experientially. But yet, Brahman is unknowable. So the whole thing is to escape. It's to escape the illusion. To escape the illusion that this world is real, to escape the illusion that you're an individual, because remember, all is one. So the whole idea of you're an individual, you're a person, you're separate, there's distinctions in categories, is all an illusion, because everything is really one. So, karma. I wanted to say something about karma. Mukti, by the way, is just another way of saying karma, moksha. Puja is... There are three basic ways that Hindus try to escape this karma and this cycle. One is through meditation, one is through good works, and one is through puja, which is their ritualistic ceremonies, which can be done in the homes and in Hindu temples, where the priests can do them for you. So these are different ways. It's a works-based salvation. The thing that I was thinking of is, and just to show you how illogical it is, there's so many questions that come up. It's like the more you study it, the more questions. If there's no such thing, really real distinctions, and everything's an illusion, and there's no good or evil, then how do bad actions produce bad karma, which, you know, produce the cycle of rebirth? It doesn't make sense. So of course, it reminds me of, if ever you've seen Christians debate like atheists, and you'll see like a presuppositionalist debate and show the atheist that you have to borrow from my worldview to even make your argument. Like, the atheist assumes that there's morals, even in his argument. And he has to borrow from the Christian worldview to even function, because the truth is the Christian worldview is a true worldview. And reality is based on it. And even people who oppose it still wind up using our worldview. And I noticed the same kind of things with Hinduism, because you're kind of saying there is no good or evil, but then in another sense you're saying there's good and evil. Sati, just to give you an idea of this religion, it's now outlawed, but it's still practiced in some places, which is the typical way of taking care of the deceased people in India is to burn them. So the most honorable thing a wife could do when her husband was being burned was to jump into the fire and burn herself with her husband, and jump into the flames. I think they would be heavily drugged to do this. But that was like the most honorable thing. The missionaries, thank God, ended a lot of this stuff and a lot of these laws. Yoga is a discipline for the purpose of being yoked to, and I put Brahma, it's incorrect. Brahma is an individual Hindu god. There are these three major gods, Hindu, Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. That should be in Brahman with an N at the end of it. That's a typo. Is the ultimate reality. So the purpose of yoga is to be yoked with Brahman. When I go to India and I tell people how Americans do yoga for health, they laugh, and they really get a good laugh out of that, because there's a saying in Hinduism that there's no yoga without Hinduism, and there's no Hinduism without yoga. There's no such thing as doing yoga for any other reason than to be yoked to Brahman, the ultimate reality. Hindu scriptures, there's four Vedas. There's the Vedas. There's four of them. I mentioned them there. The Upanishads, or the Vedanta, which is kind of like a commentary. It's called the end of the Vedas. The Puranas, which are a bunch of poems and songs, and that has a lot of stories about the gods. The Mahabharata is another one, of which the Bhagavad Gita is just one part. But the Bhagavad Gita is one of the most famous writings in all of Hinduism, and it's about Krishna and Arjuna, who are these different gods in Hinduism. And there's Ramayana, and there's more writings, but these are the major writings. Now, Hindus will tell you that we're the world's oldest religion. That's one of the objections we're going to go to. And by the way, I put a couple of objections on my handout, but karm.org, who really got some great stuff, I don't agree with them in everything, but they got some great stuff. They had 12 objections. I couldn't believe that there was someone who actually did 12 objections to Hinduism. So we'll look at least 5 today. I'll do one from karm and the other 4 that I picked that maybe were not all on there. But they'll say, I'll deal with this objection now since I'm on the topic. They say that we're the world's oldest religion. That's one of the most common things you'll hear from a Hindu. They're boast. You know, Christianity is only 2,000 years old, and you know, we go back. Some will say 5,000 years to like 3,000 BC. Some will say 10,000 years. The Vedas was written. Okay. The more straight up answer is to put the burden on them, because it's not true. There's no, scholars will say it was maybe written between 1200 and 1500 BC, the oldest of all Hindu scriptures, the Rig Veda, which is the first, but which actually is not as old as some of the first writings of it's right around the time of the beginning of Scripture. But the thing that I would try to explain first is, even if it were true that they had the oldest religion, really, what was the first religion? The first religion in the Bible was the fig leaf. You know, it was the fig leaf in the garden. I mean, the truth is, God created man. Man fell. God had always revealed His truth to people. We read about Enoch, the seventh from Adam. He was a prophet. His writings are not recorded. So the truth is, in the time of Moses, which was a couple of thousand years after creation, that's when God gave the revelation, but it goes back to the time from before time began, in the beginning. So we have revelation from the beginning. So the real issue is not who has the oldest scriptures anyway. When you understand, and actually you can use this opportunity to explain the salvation story, to explain the gospel, to explain the whole meta-narrative of the Bible, the whole complete story, in explaining the way it developed. Man was created here, and how he called apart Abraham, and how Moses was later, and how God gave the revelation to Moses. The book of Job was probably written before the Torah, but around the time of Abraham. But in either case, you can explain that the issue, you know. So I put in here, if you go to page, let me see, I think it's towards the end. I just said, how do you define oldest religion? Do you define it by the oldest scriptures? Do you define it by the founder? You know, Abraham goes back before the time of the writing of the Rig Veda. You know, and then again, just explain the whole narrative of the Bible, and explain the salvation story, and explain how it goes back to the beginning. And man has always had other religions from the beginning, and there was the truth. There was always two ways from the beginning. And it was only we only have official writings of both the true and the false religion going back to a certain time. But again, it's a springboard for the gospel. Now, going back to page 3, they have a caste system in which, if there's higher caste and lower caste. I mentioned the caste here, the Brahmins. Now, here, there's three different. There's Brahma, B-R-A-H-M-A, who's one of the just Hindu gods. There's Brahman, which is the ultimate reality. And then there's Brahmin, with the I-N, who is the highest caste in Hinduism. So just not to get confused between those three terms. And then you have the warrior caste, and then you have the merchant caste, and then you have the Sudras, and then you have the untouchables, which are below the lowest caste. So, and this all has to do with reincarnation. So if you're a Brahmin, you apparently are a higher level. You're closer to achieving moksha. You're closer to escaping that wheel of samsara, that cycle of rebirth. And I believe a cow is even higher than a human, and that's why cows are so revered, because they're even closer if I understand correctly, to achieving that. But now, another thing to understand, we're on the general truths, to understand, just like with Judaism, just like with Catholicism, where a lot of people don't understand religion, a lot of Hindus don't understand their own religion. Even in India, there are probably a good amount that do, but the guy on the plane, he was a Brahmin, and he didn't even know who Brahmin was, or the real thing, and he just gave me some booklet to read, and I gave him Death of a Guru, and... But the thing is, he didn't really even understand it. So keep that in mind. And because there's so many different belief systems, one of the things you want to do when you're talking to a Hindu is talk to them. Don't just assume that you know what they believe, because it's such a varied belief system. They could believe in all different kinds of things. Find out what they believe. And then, you know, deal with them accordingly. And then try to address the gospel with them based on what they know. But listen to them too, just to see where they're coming from. Okay, now, one of the things that, there was this unbeliever, this guy was not even a Christian, but he would go on TV, and he would just rip apart Hinduism. He was probably like, who's that atheist guy? Name a famous atheist. Huh?
Hawkins.
Yeah, Hawkins. He was probably like the Hawkins for Hindus, like, you know, trying to prove it. But he actually respected Jesus and Christianity, believe it or not. But he would go on TV, and he was a political figure, famous, and he would just rail against the Hindu gods, how immoral they were. because these are supposed to be their gods. So I have three stories here, just to give you, this is a tool you can use as God leads. I would be tempted to use this in an arrogant way, but yet use it in a way to just respectfully say, hey, are these the people you revere as gods? There's one story with Shiva, and some of them get a little bit explicit here, and sexual, believe it or not, but I'll, just try to get you'll get the gist of the story. Once all the gods came to Shiva and complained that all the rishis are the ones who supposedly wrote the Vedas. They were supposedly inspired. They were inspired. They were inspired by demons, and they really were. When you really study this stuff, they really were. But the gods came to Shiva, complaining all complaining about the rishis because their desires were not acceptable, and so they complained about it because they were committing adultery in their wives and stuff. So Shiva asked Vishnu to take care of it, and so the way Vishnu takes care of it is he becomes the only time Vishnu, he's a male god, becomes a female avatar. By the way, an avatar, I didn't put that in the definitions, is when a god manifests and becomes the movie Avatar. This is everywhere. But when these gods manifest and become human, take on human form. So Vishnu becomes a female, very exotic, attractive female, and satisfies the desires of all the rishis. Alan said he couldn't tell me the details of what's described there, of how, but he says he couldn't even repeat it. And of course it shows they don't understand sin, because the belief was if he just satisfies them, then they'll stop being immoral. That's not the way sin works. But again, this is the belief system of Hinduism. So then, the wives found out and what happened, and they were kind of all upset at Shiva. And then Shiva goes down and he becomes an avatar, and he becomes this beautiful, handsome man, and he satisfies all the women. And then there were these two groups of people. I'm just trying to the reason I'm telling you all these stories is just to, in case you want to keep them in mind, because these are well-known stories that you might be familiar with. And, if people are saying, this is my religion, these are the gods that we worship, these are our major gods, you could just be aware of these stories. And then there was two groups of people. One said Shiva, Shiva. And if you go in a Hindu temple, sometimes it says Shiva, Shiva. Or once they'll say it twice. The Shiva, Shiva people, they said it twice because they were angry at Shiva that he did this. And others were saying, no, it was okay. He's a guy, he can do it. But this story shows their lack of understanding of sin. It shows that the immorality of the people who wrote their holy scriptures, the Vedas, because the story itself says they were committing immorality. This is their own writings, and it shows you that their rishis were committing this immorality. It shows the immorality of the gods. Another lovely story is about, Ganesh, the guy with the elephant head. Well, basically, Ganesh was supposedly born because he came to be from the dirt of his mother's bathing. So when he grew up, he lusted after his mother. And the story basically goes, so then one day he was desiring her, and Shiva didn't know it was his son. He knew someone was lusting after his wife. This is Shiva's wife, by the way, that Ganesh was lusting after. And so Shiva cuts off his head, not knowing it was his son. And then the mother gets all mad, and what did you do? And then, so then Shiva goes out and finds an elephant and takes the head and puts it on him. And the story is that to this day, Ganesh remains single, still waiting for his mother to say yes. So this is some stories. And then I'll tell you the story of Sita and Rama. Hari Rama. Sita and Rama were married, and these are the ideal couple. These are venerated as the people to look up to, like the model husband or the model wife. Sita and Rama, they're considered the embodiment of marriage, and Hindus talk very highly of these two people. Well, basically, Sita says that Rama looks handsome, but he really doesn't have any masculinity, and I'm without going into detail because I guess she didn't like his performance, and that's all I'll say. And she says he just deceives everybody with his beauty, but he's not worthy of worship. So later she's kidnapped by this evil king, Ravana, and in captivity, she starts liking the guy who kidnapped her and commits adultery with him. And then later Rama comes and finally rescues her. And then, when he addresses what happened, she says, well, I was really thinking of you. And this is the model family here, very revered. So these are just things that you can. The reason I'm telling you this for a purpose, you can bring these issues up and you can question. Hey, you know, these stories, because they're well known in Hinduism, and the references are here if you want to check them out. To question, you know, their objects of worship. Krishna was a womanizer. He committed adultery on people. He stole women's clothing when they were bathing. This is Krishna. This is another one of their biggest, quote-unquote, Lord Krishna. So again, things to explain to them when you show them this is they have no concept of the true God, you know, and explain to them the purity and the perfect holiness of the true God. I love 1 John chapter 1, verse 5. God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. And so many other verses that you can use to point to the perfect purity and holiness of God compared to of the true God. So there's a bunch of scriptures that just can be used in general to refute pantheism. Genesis 1:1 shows that there's a creator and who's separate from creation from the beginning. There's a bunch of verses, Isaiah 14, and they're in your notes, Ezekiel, Genesis 3, Isaiah 44:6, Deuteronomy 4:35, which all talk about I am the Lord, there is none else, which refutes their polytheism. And then there's Isaiah 46:1-10, which refutes their idolatry. And Psalm 115:1-3. So these are just some scriptures you can use and explain to them, which directly conflict with their belief system. So some questions, again, you can, again, learn and find out where they're coming from before you just preach to them, because you might not know, first of all, you might not know how much Hinduism they know. Secondly, you might not know where they're coming from. But based on that, these are all different things in your arsenal that you could keep when ministering to them. So one objection we dealt with was we're the oldest religion. I just want to jump to the objections. Just read the notes, because I went from teaching 6 hours a day to now covering two major world religions in 45 minutes. So a little bit of a gear shift there. I taught 36 hours in 6 days. And now we're talking about a religion covering 1.4 billion people in two religions. In 45 minutes, so I'm doing my best here. Okay. Claim two. All the religions of the world lead to the same destination. We're like droplets of water joining a stream, leading to the ocean. And basically, I'll just refer you to the class Damien taught, Answering the Cult, What Makes You Right and Everyone Else Wrong. That's just a common argument that other people use also. Three, we don't change anybody's religion. Why are Christians always trying to change other people's religion? Because they're very pluralistic, and again, you basically just explain that if it's the truth, and if it's a matter of your eternal destiny, then, you know, we need to tell you this, if this is God's command and revelation. By the way, a scripture refuting reincarnation obviously would be, I didn't put it in your notes, Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to man to die once, and then the judgment. You could see how reincarnation could be give people a false hope for another chance after death. And you want to show them that there is no other chance. And let's see. So another objection. Christ's teaching is a reflection of the teaching of the Hindu gurus. You probably have heard stuff like that. Jesus went to India and he hung out with the gurus and he came back. And Jesus was just really teaching Hinduism. And you guys just misinterpret his teachings. And basically, the response to that is just to show Jesus' teachings in context, show how Jesus' teachings of one God, who really was Jewish, and the entire Old Testament, which totally abhorred the idea of multiplicity of gods, completely could not fit with their Hindu system. But that's what they try to say. I had some quotes here, but I'm not going to have time to get to them from some of their gurus, which basically blaspheme Christ, that say we should, when we do evil, it's good, that basically support every kind, there's been every kind of things, there's been some of these people have been busted from murder to drugs to illicit sex with pedophilia and everything else, but again, that belief system lends itself to this kind of thing. And again, Charles Manson, and you see the guru is basically openly blaspheming Christ. There's a lot of quotes I have, but I don't have time to get into it. Of course, either they'll praise a false Christ or blaspheme the true Christ. So let me, and the last objection is in the other handout at frycarm.org. And it basically is, we're an Eastern religion and you're a Western religion. So this is really for me, because I'm an Easterner. And basically the answer to that is, first of all, Christianity is not a Western religion. It started in the Middle East, in Israel. You also explain it's not exclusive. It's for all people in heaven. Revelation, I think, 7:9, there's people from all tribes, tongues, and people coming. Number three, even though it's exclusive in turn that only those who believe in Jesus can be saved, it's open to all. Jesus has come. Who is thirsty, come. Revelation 22, Isaiah 55, come and drink freely. So the invitation goes out to the world. So you want to emphasize that, because they have this idea of narrowness. But so our faith is narrow, but it's not exclusive, and all are called to come. You can show the parable of the wedding supper, where all are told to come, and there were people. So these are, that might be a good thing to show them. But it's not just for the East. And as a matter of fact, the first believers were from the Middle East, and it spread to India in the very early with the Apostle Thomas. So the West, it spread to the West later on with Paul. Okay, let me go on to Buddhism here. Now, Buddhism, I didn't do any objections, but I made some points. Buddhists don't really have objections as much as answer our objections. There's a book I found online called Beyond Belief, and it was responding to all the Christian arguments against Buddhism. So it's actually a great place to find Christian arguments against Buddhism. But basically, Buddhism and it has some similar things to Hinduism, but yet they're different. Believe it or not, Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama was born around 560 BC, died 480 BC. It's getting very popular in the United States. There's about 400 million Buddhists, fourth largest religion in the world. But the first formal biography was about 600 years later. Now, here's the story of Buddha. His dad was a chieftain, rich. He had all the comforts of the palace, never went outside. His father didn't let him out. But one day he left the palace, went out, and he saw four things. And he saw pain. He saw an old man, a leper, a corpse, and an ascetic. And then he went the ascetic way, because he was blown away. Then he realized that didn't work, and then he came to this thing called the middle way, where you don't have, you don't seek extreme pleasure, but you don't seek extreme asceticism either. Now, there's a lot of things to cover here. There's literally probably thousands of sects of Buddhism, thousands, but there's probably 3 to 5 major divisions. There's the Theravada, also known as Hinayana branch. They're the ones that supposedly practice the purest, oldest form of Buddhism. And their goal is mainly just to seek enlightenment for themselves. Then there's the Mahayanas, which their whole thing is, hey, it's selfish for us to just do this for ourselves. So the Mahayanas talk about these people called Bodhisattvas. You ever see, by the way, there's a salon in my neighborhood, and you see it a lot more now, Bodhi. I don't know if you've ever seen any stores or shops. It's kind of like in now. Bodhi. You're going to probably start seeing a lot more of these New Age Eastern terms everywhere in society. But it has to do with illumination or wisdom. But a bodhisattva is somebody that pretty much achieved nirvana, but they don't enter it because they want to stay here to help other people achieve salvation. So they're more about giving. They're very much into good works and helping society. They're very, they're very humanitarian in that sense. Whereas the other people, the Theravadas, is more just about seeking enlightenment for themselves. And Zen, there's so many branches. Zen could be considered, some people consider it a different branch. Some people see it as part of the Mahayana branch. It came through the Mahayana branch. And then there's Tibetan Buddhism, or Vajrayana. And this is really a lot mixed with a lot of the animism from Tibet. This kind of Buddhism even has animal sacrifices. And there's so many subsects, like I said, probably thousands. Now, here's the thing. Very interesting thing to know. Buddha never claimed to be divine, never claimed to be God. That's something that evolved later. And some Buddhists today will say, yeah, well, he's not an object of worship, even though they'll sometimes say his statue, it helps us focus. But and they probably really do worship him. But Buddha never taught worship of himself. He never claimed to be divine. And he never claimed divine inspiration. So how do you come up with all that? Look at some of his teachings. Now, so he also believes in, Buddhism also teaches reincarnation. There's a variation from Hinduism. Not going to have time to get into that. They also believe in karma, or kamma, K-A-M-M-A, it could be spelt that way. sounds like someone from Boston saying karma. But they do not believe in a soul. Buddhism believe in it's some people even view it more as a philosophy than a religion, even though it really is a religion, because they do talk about this achievement of nirvana. They also Buddha also taught that everything's an illusion. Now, when Buddha had his enlightenment, you know, he came up with his there's the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The Four Noble Truths that Buddha came up with is this: life is suffering. Two, craving, which means the craving is what causes the suffering. If you don't desire, you don't suffer, right? The only reason we suffer is because we have desire. Three, cessation of desire is the goal, because if you cease desiring, then you'll cease suffering. So the goal of Buddhism is, it's not salvation from sin, it's really to end suffering. It's really to deal with suffering. It's dealing with a symptom rather than dealing with a problem. That's what Buddhism is doing. It's dealing with the symptom of suffering. We know suffering comes from the fall and from sin, but they're just, it's mainly just trying to directly deal with the symptom of suffering. And then so cessation is the third noble truth. And fourth, the path leading to cessation is the middle path, or the Eightfold Path. And that is what, that's the steps that they follow in the way they try to work it out to get to the place where they can have that cessation of desire, where they no longer desire, and they achieve nirvana. Nirvana is the state of being blown out. It doesn't necessarily mean nothingness, but again, everything's an illusion. So where yourself disappears, you no longer believe the lie. I have some quotes that I'd like to get to. The lie that you are self, that you're an individual. You know, that's all part of the illusion. So again, there's some borrowing from Buddhism from Hinduism, but also the other way around too. Hinduism later borrowed from Buddhism, seems like. So, and they have these five precepts: no killing, including animals, not even an ant. You know. No stealing, no illicit sexual activity, no wrong speech, and believe it or not, no drugs or alcohol. So if you've known any Buddhists, you'll see that they're into this. No drugs or alcohol. Here's a quote, I believe, from Buddha. The whole world, a delusion is nothing but a shadow caused by the mind. There is no world outside the mind. Things have no reality in themselves, but are like heat, haze. So to the Buddha, everything definitive is an illusion. And, it's a mistake to regard the world as either temporal or as a real one, but ignorant people of this world assume, I think this should be in quotes, that it is a real world and proceed to act on that absurd assumption. So if you are acting as if this world is real, you're absurd. You're treating it like reality. So the question is, should I treat his teachings as real? Should I, why, you know, it's self-refuting. He's saying, we're going to get to that, but he's telling you that if you treat anything as real, it's absurd, but yet he's expecting you to take his teachings as real and to apply them. So that's absurd. That's the true absurdity. He says, a wise man, recognizing the world is but an illusion, does not act as if it were real. So I guess we all have to mature to that point of wisdom where we stop acting like things are real. So he escapes the suffering. So again, reincarnation, karma, one's actions govern the future. It might be more of an influence on the future as opposed to Hinduism, where it just completely affects who you're going to be in the next life. Again, nirvana, the goal of Buddhism, enlightenment, the void blowing out, the quenching of this desire. I'm just giving you some different terms. Palikanan is the earliest Theravadan scriptures. I told you what a bodhisattva is from Mahayana Buddhism. Again, so some key points is they deny the biblical doctrine of human depravity and of sin. I mean, they're not, again, all of this to deal with suffering and not any discussion of sin, which is the ultimate problem in the universe. And they talk about us being good. Look at this quote: abandon evil. One can abandon evil. If it were impossible to abandon evil, I would not ask you to do so. But as it can be done, therefore I say abandon evil. Then cultivate the good. One can cultivate the good. If it were impossible to cultivate the good, I would not ask you to do so. But as it can be done, therefore I say cultivate the good. So basically pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and be good in your own strength. Whereas salvation, we are unable to be good. Romans 7, who will rescue me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ. Buddhism teaches that one should cultivate love and doesn't recognize their inability to do this apart from Christ. Jesus, I'm the vine, you're the branches. No, you, apart from me, you can do nothing. Okay, and they have a quote there about love. It's a mistake to regard the world... Oh, yeah, I think that I may have put that in there twice, that quote. Okay, so most Buddhists don't believe in an ultimate deity. They don't believe in a soul. But they do believe... So what gets reincarnated if there's no soul? They say, well, it's energies. And there's these ever-flowing different energies which are always in different balances. So you come back from different parts of those energies. But they make a distinction from the soul. So they disagree with even Hinduism because Hinduism teaches a soul, the Atman. But they say, no, you don't have a soul. Buddhism, again, seeks to deal with the symptom. And Buddhists can't explain... Yes, self is an illusion. There's no savior in Buddhism. These are things you could keep in mind if you're talking to a Buddhist. There's no savior. You're expected to save yourself by the Eightfold Path and hopefully achieving nirvana after many rebirths. So a major point, Siddhartha never claimed to be God, never claimed inspiration. So how, without being God, and yet not even claiming divine inspiration like the rishis did in Hinduism, how do you get this information about karma, this law of karma? If there's no ultimate deity, who governs this law of karma? Who controls it? Who created it, if there's no higher power? These are just questions. That last question, I don't think I wrote it down, but you might want to jot that down. Who governs these laws if there's no ultimate deity? But ultimately, how would you even know about rebirth and what happens after death and rebirth and death and rebirth in the cycle if you're not divine and you're not claiming divine inspiration? I don't get it. So let your Buddhist friends know that this is a man claiming to be a man, not even claiming that a higher deity even gave him the revelation, and he's teaching us about things that have to do with life after death and about who we are and our being. Where did he get this information? And again, even if it's true, who governs these things without there being a true God? Another point, Buddha is dead, and Jesus is alive. And Buddha compared his teachings to a raft that ought to be left behind. Once on the other side, a river is reached, but the word of God endures forever. So he even said his teachings were just for a temporary purpose. Again, his teachings were written centuries later. That's why there's so many different sects and disagreements about how to interpret what he said. He said, only obey the major points. Problem is, he never described what the major points was, and there's all these different sects that developed. And so, questions for Buddhists, was Buddha an illusion? If not, why not? How did the illusion begin in the first place? But that's another question for Hindus, by the way. How did Brahman basically forget that he's God? You know, how did God somehow lose himself in an illusion? I think one teaching says he did it as a trick, but how does an impersonal being want to trick people? Anyhow, just question, the more you think, the more questions come up. Okay, why is the mind treated as real, but everything outside the mind treated as an illusion? Because this is according to Buddha's quote. He treats the mind as if it's a real thing, but everything outside the mind is an illusion. If Buddha taught this, then wasn't everything outside his mind an illusion? Wouldn't that include other people's minds? So, if his mind is the only real thing, then and Buddha was teaching, why would he be teaching us and our minds? If there's no self, then how can there be reincarnation? Well, I think the answer to that could be the energy thing. Why the search for nirvana? And why even believe such notions if they're not of divine origin? So...